I have been given a Danish big book, and I have carefully, although not always accurately, gone through the passages that I'm going to talk about with the references to the Danish book. I haven't done that with the Swedish or the Greek or the Italian or the or any of the others, but I have done it with the Danish. I will tell you the reference, but sometimes I'll be reading the middle of the paragraph, and sometimes the page number that the paragraph starts on, the reference I'll be reading is on the next page. You'll have to do your best if you want to follow the Danish version. Let me put it this way. The big book was written it was published in 1939. And the page numbers, the little book? Well, the little book has the same page numbers as the big one, if it's in English. There are some parts of it that won't be in that version. Some parts that I'll be referring to that won't be in that version, but not many. What I'm going to be giving to you is what I have learned from Joe and Charlie, all three of them, and Blaine, with a mixture of a bunch of other things I've learned as well, and a lot of the history of AA, as it gives us guidance for working the steps in Overeaters Anonymous. I'm not a member of any other 12-step program. You know, this is not working. We have the backup anyway, so. Yeah. I should say that since we are being recorded, one thing I like to do is always, I don't know how many tapes you listen to or how many recordings you listen to. You have no idea where they were done, who was there, what was going on. And I think it's always important to have a sense of, when you listen to something, you get a picture in your own mind. So we are in Copenhagen, not Copenhagen, I know, it's Copenhagen, despite what Danny Kaye says. And I know I can't pronounce the Danish version of it, Copenhagen or something. Is it Copenhagen or something? Is that not bad? Okay. And we're in it's like a community center, is that what this place is? We're on the third floor in a building that the room actually has a peaked roof. It's very nice. We have a lot of, I imagine these are IKEA lights, are they, around. I'm standing at a lectern. It's Danish in design, different from very, very modern and sleek. There are about 1,000 people in the room. They're all seated at tables and wooden tables. So just to give a sense of that. The big book was published in 1939. It was written between 1938 and 1939. Almost all of it, with the exception of one chapter, and I'm referring to the first section, not the stories afterwards, but the section with the instructions, were written by Bill Wilson, the co-founder of AA, with a great deal of input from other people. At one point, I'll be referring to a draft. There was a draft version that was sent around in 1938, I think, which people made a lot of suggestions for. Bill Wilson was an amazing person. He was not always the nicest person, and there are many things about his life that are not particularly admirable. But he was a true artist, and he was certainly a brilliant writer. The book itself, I have learned to appreciate, is an inspired book. As you'll find out, and I'll tell you right now, I have no religion whatsoever and no belief in a God of any normal understanding. So when I say it's inspired, other people will say it's God-inspired. I don't blame them for saying that. I think it is inspired. I think it's as inspired as any great work of art is. Every sentence is consistent with every other part. It's as if in any great poem or great work of literature, it's a whole, and it can't be taken apart without realizing that every part of it is part of another part. I don't know if I make that all clear, but I think this is a very consistent book. It does have its problems. First of all, it was written in an old-fashioned English, even for 1939. Bill studied his main language is, he picked up English really in the 1890s, the 1900s, and it's an old-fashioned style of writing. Some of the words that he used were not words that were used that much even in 1939. Secondly, the words that he used even in 1939 don't have the same meaning in English did then. When I studied the Big Book with the man who helped sponsor me and whom I helped sponsor, he had a grade 9 education. As I told you, I studied English, I have a master's in English and philosophy. He kept correcting my meanings of the words, much to my resentment, because, you know, I knew words. That's what I do and have done. But he was always right, because he knew the dictionary from 1939, and I knew it from 1980 or 1990, whenever I was studying it. And some of the words have changed their meaning. There are a couple of other flaws with the Big Book. One is it was written by alcoholics who were in the gutter, who were truly the lowest that you could be. And so their experiences don't always speak to compulsive eaters. Many compulsive overeaters will look at the Big Book and say, why should I read it? Why doesn't he read it? Meaning some spouse or close relative who really needs Alcoholics Anonymous. The Big Book has a very checkered history in OA. At one time, it was the major book that we all read back in the 80s. And then it became a book that people were discouraged from using because we had, quote, our own literature, end quote. And I'll talk about that in a little while. It is a book that was written by men, and it is not nice to women, in a sense, as from our modern perspective. The woman in this book is the little heroine, the little girl who takes care of her man, the woman who keeps house. And and because that's reflective of the times, of course. In 1939, women were in different positions for the most part. So you can read it, and if you are a woman, as most of you are, you will read it and say that this is it's demeaning. It doesn't treat women as equals, and it doesn't. And it assumes that only men are alcoholics, at least much of the writing is. So it's hard to read. It was also written by Christians, and it's hard for me even as a Jew to read it, let alone for people who aren't, and for non-religious people. It's really hard. It was very hard for me to read it as well. There are words used in it that are, to this day, I have to do a real translation, and I'll talk about that tomorrow when I talk about step two. So it has its flaws, and sometimes these flaws, the language, the difficult language, the alcoholic background, the male orientation, the Christian orientation, these often stand in the way of being able to understand it as a significant book in the history of addiction, and as the first book which contains directions for working the steps. The 12 steps were developed, and I'll give you the history tomorrow, were developed as a series of instructions for getting recovery from compulsive eating, from addiction, from alcohol. They've been adapted to hundreds of different fellowships, hundreds of different addictions. There's a joke, which may not translate, that there's a Actors Anonymous, and this is for people who really are taxi drivers and waiters. Does that make sense to you? People who are addicted to acting, but anyway. They've been adapted, but in 1938, when the idea of the Big Book was first proposed, there were 3 meetings in all of the world, in New York, Akron, Ohio, and one starting up in Cleveland. They knew that if they were going to carry the message of the 12 steps to other people, actually there were only 6 steps at the time, but the message of this recovery from alcoholism to other people, they could not do it one-on-one. They had to have a set of directions that could be read by people who would have no contact with anyone from Alcoholics Anonymous. Actually, it wasn't even named Alcoholics Anonymous at that time. The fellowship got its name from the book. So Bill Wilson set about writing a book, and which was intended to be and is a set of instructions for working the steps. It is the only book in AA literature which is called a basic text, a textbook. There is no other book in AA literature, and frankly, there's no other book in OA literature that calls itself a textbook. The OA 12 and 12, the 12 Steps and 12 Traditions, is not a textbook. It's a series of essays written about the 12 Steps. And it clearly is not the OA way of doing the steps, even though a lot of people think it is. I don't know, I'm not sure you're selling it here, but one bestseller in the United States and Canada, in English, I don't know if it's been come out in other languages, is the 12-Step Workbook. It's a large book. Well, that isn't even approved by the Group Conscience of OA, the World Service Business Conference. It was put out by the Board of Trustees. And yet people will read that and think that is the official way of the OA way of doing the steps. It is not. And there's another pamphlet called A Guide to the 12 Steps, a Guide to Step 4, a Step 4 guide, inventory guide. That is not the approved way of doing it. It was put out by the Board of Trustees. It is not, reflective. The group conscience of OA, which is only through the World Service Business Conference, has not approved these pieces of literature at all, and certainly not as the only way of doing the big book. Give you an example. In Step 4 in our OA 12 and 12, it says many of us do the Step 4 the big book way. And then they describe another way of doing it. People have looked at the other way of doing it without realizing that even in our OA 12 and 12, it acknowledges that the big book way of doing it is a way that many use. So the big book it's controversial. In some fellowships, it's banned, you know, and certainly in OA, it is not. It is part of our OA literature. I had to restudy it. I read it for 6 or 7 years. If you recall, my friend said, I read the big book, and I say, well, I read the big book too, and I did. And it's full of wonderful language. It's full of inspiring words. Occasionally, I would get some understanding of what they were suggesting. But it wasn't until I listened to Joe and Charlie, and after Joe and Charlie, and not just listened, I've studied a lot of what they've written and what they've said. And then I listened to Blaine, this man whom you will not be able to get tapes of or recordings of, lives in Winnipeg, who is very brilliant. And he modified Joe and Charlie and I think did a better job on Step 4. And I use his forms with his permission. He's not well these days, but I was able to see him a few years ago to tell him that these forms for doing Step 4 have helped thousands and thousands of overeaters. He was very happy to know that. They are wonderful forms, and I'll be talking about them tomorrow. So the big book is hard to read, and one of the things after I studied what Joe and Charlie have to say and what Blaine had to say is to be able to develop an understanding of the book from a compulsive eating perspective, and I hope that what follows assists you. I want to read what I call provocations. I have 12 of them. I like the number 12. I don't know why. And these are provocations. They're intended to provoke. They're not intended to alienate you, but they are intended to provoke. The first time I ever read them out, I had them in a slightly stronger form. And I was at a workshop on the east coast of the United States. And a woman told me, she said, you know, Laurie, on Sunday, she said, if I hadn't paid $250 to come here, I would have left on Friday. I was so upset by what you said. Now, these provocations aren't always provocative, depending on the state of OA and what things are like. But I guarantee you that one of these sentences is provocative somewhere in OA. And all 12 can offend all kinds of people. So I'm going to read them to you, not just to provoke you, but to tell you that the big book makes things a lot simpler than most of us do the steps. You know, the big book says they're simple but not easy, and yet we make them complicated. We make it difficult to work the steps when in fact they are simple to do. And I think I'll show you. I think I'll be able to show you that the big book tells you how to do the steps in a very short time. And so here are the provocations. One of them is really provocative. It's provocative in every 12-step fellowship. I don't know whether in your languages the difference will be as obvious as it is in English, so I'll explain the difference, but I am a recovered compulsive eater, not a recovering one. In English, that's a huge difference. Recovered means it's happened to me. Recovering means I'm going through the process. And people say, I'm a recovering compulsive eater. I'm a recovering alcoholic. But the big book's approach is, I'm a recovered alcoholic. I'm different from what I used to be. And I'll prove it to you from the big book that that's the word to use. And I'll explain why when we get to step 12. The second is provocative, certainly in the United States. Abstinence is not the most important thing in my life. The consciousness of the presence of God is. And many people in OA will say, you know, I'm Lori, I'm a compulsive overeater, and abstinence is the most important thing in my life. It's not important to me at all. I am abstinent, I've been abstinent for over 20 years, but it's not important to me. And I'll explain why. And this is from the big book. I'll give you a hint. As long as I have a consciousness of the presence of my higher power, I'm sane. As long as I'm sane, I don't want to eat things that will kill me. So abstinence is taken for granted. Third, and this is very provocative, although a sponsor, if available, is very important for recovery, a sponsor is not necessary to recover. You can do the steps on your own. If you have a sponsor available, terrific. But if you don't, you can do them on your own. So it's your own responsibility to recover. You can't blame the fact that there's no sponsor around for not recovering. You can do them on your own. It's a little harder, but you can do them on your own. I did them on my own. I did them with another person who had not recovered. We guided each other. Four, and this is really different, you can recover in weeks. It can take you weeks. You can do, actually, if you really rushed, you could do it in a week. I wouldn't suggest it, but you could do it in a few weeks. You can recover. Recovery comes at step 9, and you can get through to step 9 in weeks using the big book method. And that should give you a ray of hope. You know, there are many fellowships. I have a friend who's in another fellowship who was told, you can't do step 4 until you've been in the program for a year and been sober for a year. Well, he relapsed all the time. And we'll see, the big book says we must do step 4 right away. We have a pamphlet called The Tools of Recovery. I don't know if you're familiar with it. No, good. It's a major pamphlet in the United States and Canada. People will often, there are 9 tools of recovery: abstinence, sponsorship, writing, telephone, service, action plan, anonymity, and something else. Can't even remember what they are. They are not the program. The steps are the program. Here we get to the steps. You don't take steps 1 and 2. Steps, by the way, all of these are in at that page, oabigbook.info. You can download a book that I've written for free. It's all for free. And you will see the provocations in that book. All these forms that you picked up here, you can get those forms from oabigbook.info, www.oabigbook.info. The seventh provocation, and this is really provocative to some, steps 3, 6, 7, and 8 shouldn't take a lot of time. You should do them quickly. As a matter of fact, you'll find the big book approach, you do steps 5, 6, 7, and 8 the same day. So that's a difference. 8, you don't make amends to yourself. I've heard so often in OA, well, the first person I have to make amends to is myself. Nah. The big book is all outer-directed, not inner-directed. 9, you should not, I use the word sponsor carefully, you cannot give away what you have until after step 9, because you haven't got it. 10, I don't know if you've heard this before, but I heard it all the time in the 90s and the early 2000s. Service is not slimming, contrary to what we used to hear. They used to hear, service is slimming. And I was proof that it was not slimming. But I'll talk about that. Food, now, I don't know, is this a problem anywhere in any of your groups? Food can be discussed at meetings. Are there meetings you are aware of where you can't mention food? Oh, isn't that nice? Oh, yes, I guess in Italy, is that right? I mean, it's just amazing to me. You can imagine in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting someone saying, and then I took a sip of a brown fizzy liquid. You know, it'd be laughed out of the room. And 12 is the most provocative. And I'll say it as nicely as I can. There are some people who come to OA who should take very seriously and understand what it means to have a desire to stop eating compulsively. If membership is open to anyone who has a desire to stop eating compulsively, people who come should know what that means. And they should be able to say, I really do have a desire to stop eating compulsively, therefore I want to be a member. Our meetings are used at times by people for reasons other than recovery. I use them for reasons other than recovery. You know, they're nice places not to be alone in. You meet friends, you feel comfortable, and you talk and people listen to you. I mean, that's nice sometimes if you're a nothing, you know, and you feel like a nothing, to be able to talk is nice. But do you have a desire, not you, but does this person have a desire? Have we explained enough what it means to have a desire to stop eating compulsively so that people really know the responsibilities they have in coming to the group? Because this 12 steps carry an opportunity and they also carry a responsibility. Well, the opportunity is to recover, the responsibility is to give it away. And if you don't have that in mind, and all you want to do, all a person wants to do is just have fun and feel comfortable in his or her misery, then how are our meetings making clear that that's not what the meetings are about? I'll talk about that a lot more in step 12. I'm nice today, I'm nice tomorrow, but Sunday I'm not so nice. I get you liking me a bit so I can say some not so nice things about our program. I'll give you one sense though, and I feel this very strongly. We had a World Service Convention, a World Convention, in Cleveland just this last month, in August. There were between 700 and 900 people at that World Convention. Narcotics Anonymous had a World Convention in Philadelphia the same weekend. They had 20,000. Why is our fellowship is smaller now than it was 20 years ago? Why? What are we doing wrong? We know the 12 steps work. What message are we carrying? And don't we have a responsibility to carry a better message so that our fellowship actually helps the people it should be helping? You know, I must tell you that I had this image of a Dane, you know, and as I walked the streets of Copenhagen the last three days, my image of the Dane is no longer the sort of the very svelte, tall person that I thought I'd be seeing, because all around me are people who could probably think about whether they needed Overeaters Anonymous. I'm sure that's true in every other country. We're becoming people who the countries are losing their, I don't know what they're losing. But whatever it is, we should be bigger, and we should be also more excited about the recovery that we have. You know, I don't go to the conventions anymore because they are so small. I was at our 50th convention in Los Angeles, the 50th anniversary convention. We had 1,000 people. I enjoyed myself. I saw a lot of people I knew. I should have seen a lot of people I didn't know. You know, I don't despair for a way, because I know that we do have the recovery and we will gradually learn how to carry the message, but we have not yet learned to carry the message well. And so I'm going to talk about that at length on Sunday. So what I would ask you to do as we start reading the big book is to turn to the title page. There's no number for the Danish version. But I'm going to read the English only. It says, the story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism, not are recovering. This is only 3 years into recovery, and they say had recovered. It's happened to them. And when you recover something, what have you lost and what have you gained? To recover something is to lose something and then to gain it. The answer will turn out to be sanity. I was insane, I'm no longer sane. I'm no longer insane, I'm sane. Okay, I would ask you then if to turn to page in Roman numerals XI in the English version, in the Danish version eight, page eight. When I get to about page 30, I began to do the paragraph numbers. I haven't done the paragraph numbers up to now. It's the second paragraph in the preface to the third or fourth edition. Because this book has become the basic text for our society, and Joe and Charlie point out that a textbook is a book in which people who have information convey it to people who don't. It is a book that you start from the beginning and you read it through to the end. You don't start it in the middle. You don't go to How It Works, chapter 5, and think that that's how it works. There's a reason for the introductory chapters and chapters 1, 2, 3, and 4. And it's a textbook. I'm on Recovered now. On page XIII of the big book in English and page 10 of the Danish, first paragraph. We of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And this is a theme we will see all the way through. Our problem is twofold. We often say in OA it's threefold, physical, emotional, and spiritual. In AA, in the big book, it's twofold. Mental and physical. The solution is spiritual. We are spiritually sick as well, but the solution is spiritual, to take care of the mental problem, which then deals with the physical issues. And I'll explain that as we go on. And they go on and they say, to show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. The purpose of this book is to say, do as we did and you will have what we have. That's the promise. Follow our directions and you will have recovery. Now, I am saying that I love the big book and I follow the big book's direction. And many people I know and love do the same. And I have friends who say, if you don't do it the big book way, you aren't doing it right. I don't believe that. There are many different ways of working the steps that work. I have friends who have never used the big book who have recovered, some of them more spiritual than I. So I am not suggesting that the big book is the only way of recovery. What I am suggesting is that it has two main advantages. One is that its explanation of the problem grabs any compulsive eater better than almost any other way of explaining the problem. And secondly, its solution, the way of working the steps, is fast. But if you are working your program in another way, and it's working for you, and you're not struggling, and you're not fighting, and you're not relapsing, and whatever your binge foods are not calling to you, you're not hanging on with your white knuckles, then why try anything different? But if what you're doing isn't working, if your way of working the steps isn't working for you, why not try another way? It's tried and true. It's been used for years. And it's worked for hundreds and thousands and millions of people. So it's worth trying. It's just worth trying. That's all I'm suggesting. If you don't have the kind of recovery that this book promises by working the steps the way you work it, then maybe it's worthwhile trying the steps in this book. Because I guarantee you, if you work the steps the big book way, you will have the recovery that the big book promises. I'm skipping quite a bit until we get to the forward to the third edition, which is found on page XXII of the English version and 18 of the Danish version. You don't have to turn to all of these. I'll read them to you. But it says, the 12 steps that summarize the program. And now we find out that the 12 steps are a summary of the program. The way I think to put it in language that compulsive eaters clearly would understand is the 12 steps are the ingredients and the big book is the recipe. The big book is the explanation of the steps. Sure, you can adapt the steps. And I spent many years trying to understand the steps and trying to understand, and I don't know what the words are in your own languages, the difference between in step five we say, admit it to ourselves, to God, to ourselves, the exact nature of our wrongs. And then step six is, we're entirely willing that God remove all these defects of character. And step seven is humbly ask them to remove our shortcomings. And I spent a great deal of time trying to figure the difference between wrongs, defects of character, and shortcomings. And if you read the big book, you'll find that they're all defects of character. And Bill was asked, well, why did you use these three words, these three different words? And he said, I was taught in English that you never use the same words in succeeding sentences because it's boring. So people have tried to interpret the steps word by word and get their own meaning from it. But we'll find it, we'll see in prayer and meditation in step 11, that meditation in the big book is completely different from the way we use meditation now. It's not sitting in a darkened room with a candle and silencing your thoughts. Not that there's anything wrong with that. That's a wonderful thing that people can do and do. But it is actually, as we'll see, it's actually looking for practical ways of acting for today. How do I act today? What do I do today? And meditation is simply the way of finding out what my actions will be today. Very different from the way we think of meditation, or at least many of us do. I want to turn especially to the doctor's opinion. Because the doctor, and this is... I didn't even get that. Just a minute. That's on page 19 of the Danish version. And it's on, how many of you have the third edition of Alcoholics Anonymous? Okay, and how many of you have the fourth edition? Okay. On the fourth edition, it's page XXV, and in the third edition is XXIII. 33 on the third edition, and 23 in the third edition, 25 in the fourth edition. The reason is that there's an introduction to the fourth edition, which is 2 pages long. So the third edition doesn't have that, so the page numbers are 2 less than the fourth edition. This doctor was named William Silkworth. He was called the little doctor who loved drunks. During the Depression years, he was evidently, in those days you could be this, you could be a neurologist and a psychologist and a psychiatrist all together, and a neurosurgeon all together, I guess. His expertise was in the brain. But he didn't have much money, and he went to work for a hospital called the Towns Hospital. It was a private hospital that catered to rich drunks, and drug addicts too, I assume, but rich drunks especially, dried them out and sent them on their way. And Dr. Silkworth worked with these alcoholics. He grew to love them, and he grew to despair for them. Nothing he could do would cure them. He would get them sober, he would dry them out, and they'd go back to drinking within a year. And he developed a theory which was revolutionary for his time. He published in a paper first in 1932 or 1933. You can get that somewhere on the internet, in which he first put this theory forward. It wasn't met with a great deal of acclaim, but it was his theory. And it was what he taught to Bill Wilson, the writer of the big book. So when the big book was being published, Bill Wilson asked Dr. Silkworth first to write a letter of recommendation, and that's the first letter in this chapter, and then to write a more detailed letter setting out his theory, which he did in the second letter. So I'm only going to have time to work on that. So Dr. Silkworth's first letter is simply a letter of recommendation, and you'll find on a page XXVI, 26 in the fourth edition, XXIV, 24 in the third edition, 20 in the Danish version, just before his signature, it says, "You may rely absolutely on anything they say about themselves," which is quite a letter of recommendation. But he knew that the program was all about honesty. It was all about being honest. And when they were, when their souls were being put into this book, he knew that you could rely on anything they said. Now, right after his signature, you'll find four paragraphs in a larger, well, it may not be a larger type, but these are now written by Bill Wilson. It says, the physician who at our request gave us this letter has been kind enough to enlarge upon his views in another statement which follows. In this statement, he confirms what we who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe. People say there are no musts, everything is suggestion. The big book is full of musts. And this is one thing we must believe. What must we believe? That the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. It did not satisfy us to be told that we could not control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life, that we were in full flight from reality, or were outright mental defectives. These things were true to some extent, in fact, to a considerable extent with some of us. But we are sure, we're certain, that our bodies were sickened as well. In our belief, any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out this physical factor is incomplete. I rejected that for 6 or 7 years in this program, which is one of the reasons I relapsed. I didn't want to believe that there was something different about my body. I believed, along with every diet I had ever been on and every diet I've ever read, that once I lost my weight, I could go back and eat everything in moderation. The diet from the weight loss program I used to be part of, once I reached my goal weight, it was called, I could go on maintenance, and maintenance would allow me a scoop of ice cream, or two cookies, or a half a donut. And I had that scoop of ice cream, and the next week I weighed fine. The next week I had that scoop of ice cream and a cookie. I may be exaggerating, it may have happened over a period of 3 or 4 months. But by the end of 6 months, I had my scoop, spoon in the big package of ice cream, and I was just eating it, and my mind was saying, why am I doing this? I lost all my weight. Why am I eating? I've got to stop, and I could not stop. And this happened to me all the way through my first 6 or 7 years. I would take back the foods, we used to call it taking back the foods in this weight loss program, and I would gain my weight again. But one of the reasons, and you won't find doctors saying anything about this. There's not much research done on this. They're trying, and there's more research now. The latest issue of Scientific American has an article about addiction with food. The whole magazine is about food. But the words that are used here in the next paragraph are very difficult words to understand. They go on. They say, the doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol interests us. As laymen, our opinion as to its soundness may, of course, mean little, but as ex-problem drinkers, we can say that his explanation makes good sense. Now, I remember reading this with my friend who really, really, really read the big book and saying, I don't have an allergy to food. I love food. It doesn't make me sick. I've never vomited because of food. I never have, actually. Never, never in my whole life, despite everything I've ever eaten, I've never vomited. I've never gotten a rash. I've never gotten coughs. My throat has never swelled. I'm not allergic to food, to any food. And this friend of mine with his grade 9 education said, look it up in the dictionary. Well, I have the two greatest dictionaries of the English language in my office. And I looked them up. Interestingly enough, I couldn't find the word allergy. It's a very young word. I had to look them up in the supplements to these great dictionaries. Allergy meant in 1939, as Dr. Silkworth was using it, it meant simply an abnormal reaction to a substance. Any abnormal reaction. We think of it as meaning hives or rashes or coughs or things of that. But it's any abnormal reaction. And what we'll find out as the doctor explains in the next letter, that the allergic reaction I get from food, certain foods, is cravings, the need to have more. My body's saying more, 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 overpowering my mind. That's the allergic reaction. It's an abnormal reaction. My wife doesn't have that. Tell you my story. My wife, the saint, she has never. She grew up in a household that cooked British, so that's already, you know, it's sad. It's very sad. My mother-in-law was a great pastry chef, but she. What she did to meat was awful. But at any rate, And I used to cook spicy. I have a Russian Jewish background, but I dabbled in Chinese and other kinds of foods. I love to cook. I don't think my mother-in-law had ever heard of garlic, ever, in her life. Maybe onions, but not often. But anyway, one day, early on in our marriage, my wife rejected all the food I cooked. We went to my in-laws for supper, and my wife started to squeal. Oh, Mom's made spring potatoes. Now, spring potatoes are the little potatoes that are cooked in a roast, and they're put on the bottom of the pan, and they get very crisp because of the juices and the fat from the roast, especially when it's cooked the British style where there's nothing left in the meat. You know, it's all gray. So the, at any rate, she began to eat them in a way that I'd never seen her eat before. We had known each other, dating for many years, and not that many years, but for years, and I'd never seen her eat with such gusto. She would take these little potatoes, and she cut them in half, and just ate them, and ate them, and ate them, until on her plate was left a half a potato. And she put her fork and knife down. And I looked at that half a potato, and I said very nicely and gently, "Aren't you going to eat that?" "Oh, I can't, I'm full." "Oh, I know, no." She actually took that half a potato, cut that half in half, and ate the quarter of the potato and put her fork and knife down. I said, so there's a little tiny piece of potato left. And I said, "Aren't you going to eat that?" She said, "No." I said, "Why not?" She said, "Because I'm full." I said, "Why aren't you eating it?" I almost yelled at her. And she said, "Because I'm full." And I don't know what that means. I've never in my life known what it is to be so full that you cannot eat a quarter of a potato, something that you love. But that's my wife. As I said, I should have realized I'm like that with alcohol. You know, I have been given at times, I once had the opportunity to drink a bottle of wine that was nectar, very expensive bottle of wine. I could have drunk the whole bottle. I mean, it was available to me. I poured myself a big glassful because I'd never in my life had wine taste that good. I could eat a third, I could drink a third of it. At a certain point, my body said, "You're full." But I never realized that my relationship to alcohol, which is completely foreign to any alcoholic, what alcoholic would understand that? You know, I mean, I've eaten bad ice cream, I've eaten good ice cream. It has rarely made a difference to me. And many alcoholics would say the same thing. It'd be nice to have great wine, but who cares as long as I get some wine. So I didn't realize that this was abnormal, but my wife is normal in that respect. If she eats too much, she gets what the doctor would call a sense of unease and discomfort. But when I eat certain foods, I get a sense of ease and comfort. It puts me into a zone. I don't know if that means much, but I just get into this zone. So we'll see what he says. But there are four good reasons for an overeater, compulsive eater, to accept the notion that we have allergic reactions, an abnormal reaction that gives us cravings. The first is it takes away the guilt. It's not our fault. I mean, we may have abused our bodies to the point that we got this way, but it isn't our fault. We are overcome by a power that is greater than our minds. And that is the addiction that we have to this food, the cravings, the physical cravings. Secondly, it is clear that we cannot recover until we abstain from the things that cause us these allergic reactions. Because so long as we have these allergic reactions, we'll always overeat. Our bodies will tell us to overeat. And we won't be able to stop our bodies from doing that. Third, for the compulsive eater especially, it gives us the opportunity, well, the responsibility, to figure out what causes our cravings. What are we allergic to? Because unlike the alcoholic who knows I don't drink alcohol in any form, the drug addict who knows in Narcotics Anonymous I don't take drugs in any form, each one of us can be allergic to different kinds of things. In this room, there is no doubt there are people who can eat what I can't eat, and vice versa. There are people who can't eat what I can eat. I think we overlap a lot. But my experience is there are people who are completely different from me in terms of what they can and can't eat. It is our responsibility as compulsive eaters to figure it out. And our Dignity of Choice pamphlet, you don't have a copy of it here, but our Dignity of Choice pamphlet, which represents the group conscience of Overeaters Anonymous, makes it very clear, someone else's plan of eating may not be the right plan of eating for you. I'm going to talk tomorrow about how to figure out what your plan of eating should be, how to get abstinent. But there are all kinds of people in OA who are going to say, follow my plan of eating. And that's contrary to the group conscience of Overeaters Anonymous. There's nothing wrong to say, why don't you try my plan of eating? But another thing to say, you must. Because that is contrary to the group conscience of Overeaters Anonymous. I know I'm stepping on some toes here. At least I'm told I will be stepping on some toes if I say that. But that is what the group conscience of Overeaters Anonymous says. I'll talk more about that tomorrow. The fourth reason why it's important to think of an allergy is this. Some of us are people pleasers. Does that ring a bell with some of you? Yes. And this allows us, when someone offers us some food and says, I made it for you especially, to say, no thank you, I just found out I'm allergic to it. Who's going to make you eat anything you're allergic to? Now, what if they push you and say, well, what happens with this allergy? I'll give you three answers. The answer I give is, oh, well, I'm a member of Overeaters Anonymous, and let me tell you all about the allergy of the body, and if you know anyone who could use Overeaters Anonymous, please refer them to me, because I think it's important to talk about it and to make sure that people have heard of Overeaters Anonymous. Some people are a little more embarrassed to say that, so there are two other things they can say. One is, I break out in fat. It's not bad, an allergic reaction, you break out in fat. And the third is, my bum or my bottom begins to swell, which is not a bad one. So in this book, just in the next paragraph, it says, more often than not, it is imperative that a man's brain be cleared before he is approached. And in the doctor's opinion later on, he says, and this is paragraph in the Danish version, page 21, of course an alcoholic ought to be freed from his physical craving for liquor. The big book takes sobriety for granted. Of course you get sober. You can't imagine going into AA and saying, I'm going to continue drinking and work the steps. And yet there are people in OA who think they can continue eating and work the steps, and somehow the steps will give them the recovery without the while they still eat. And I can tell you, I can tell you a story that is one of the most tragic I know in OA. I had a friend, he was a big book fanatic. He was an AA, a Narcotics Anonymous, and OA. He knew the big book better than I do. He used to teach the big book. He used to give his own big book workshops. He never got abstinent in OA. He phoned me up once. He had been in OA longer than I had been in OA. He had been in AA longer than I had been in OA. He said, would you sponsor me? I said, I'm flattered. I met with him. I said, let's work out a plan of eating for you. He said, I can't. I can't get abstinent. I want to work the steps. I said, what would you say if you were in AA to an AA person who said, will you please sponsor me, but I'll keep on drinking? I won't give you the language he used, but he would tell him to go away. I said, what do you want me to say to you? And he begged me to sponsor him. So I sponsored him. He did step four, he did step five. He said he had never done a better step five. He made his amends, and he continued to eat. And about 3 or 4 years later, he committed suicide. The funeral was, there were 300 or 400 people there, members of AA, NA, and OA. We loved this man. If he had phoned us in the middle of the night just before he committed suicide, if he had phoned us, he would have had 400 people coming to help him. We would all have just dropped anything to help this man because we loved him, and he died alone. He couldn't get honest with himself. You can't be honest and still eat while working these steps. But put it this way, you can't work these steps without being honest. And how can you be honest if you're fooling yourself about your eating? So the big book takes it for granted. I just want to go on and talk a bit about the doctor, and then we'll break for today. The doctor says, and this is on page 28 in the fourth edition, 26, Roman numerals 26 in the third, XXVIII or XXVI, page 21 in the Danish version. We believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy. Now, a manifestation is the symptom. It's the equivalent of the hives or the rash or the tightening of the anaphylactic shock, the tightening of the throat. It is the, and for us, so it's the manifestation is the symptom, the outcome of what happens when the allergy comes on. Then he explains what the manifestation is. The phenomenon of craving is limited to this class. Now, what is a phenomenon? Greek word, right? Plural is phenomena, right? And I don't know what it means in Greek now, but it certainly means in English an occurrence, an event for which there is no explanation. It just happens. So he calls it a phenomenon because it is something he has no explanation for. It's just something that happens. And he calls it the phenomenon of craving. He doesn't know why it happens, but he finds that in alcoholics, they get cravings. And he says these allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. And he goes on a few more paragraphs, and I'm going to quit with reading these words and with some explanation. This is on page, it's the same page in the English version, but page 22 in the Danish version. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation, now I don't know about you, if you're like me, you've had a moment when nothing felt good until you took something of what you were addicted to and suddenly, I'm home. You know that feeling. And that's what they mean. The sensation is so elusive, that means it runs away from them. You can't really point to it. That while they admit it is injurious, while they admit it does them harm, they cannot after a time differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. I remember when I was going out with my wife, before I fell in love with her, wondering if I could marry a woman who did not enjoy food as much as I did. There must be something wrong with her, I thought. I remember that feeling. She doesn't love food. There must be something. She must not have passion. It's something. And then some important words. They are restless, irritable, and discontented, unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks. So first of all, the sense of ease and comfort, the zone, being home. And the other is the concept of restless, irritable, and discontented. And I'm coming back to those when I talk about step 10. Because whenever I get restless or irritable or discontented, I know it's time to do step 10. But I'll talk about that probably tomorrow, late afternoon or early Sunday morning. So I'll stop here in about 2 minutes. I just want to say this. We hear often in OA, well, alcoholics just have to stop drinking, but we still have to eat. You know, I'm sure you've heard that. And I'm sure you've thought that. And so did I. But someone pointed out to me that that's not a correct analogy. Alcoholics must drink. They just can't drink alcohol. You need liquid. Everyone needs liquid. You just can't drink this form of liquid. And I need to eat, but I don't have to eat the foods that kill me. And as long as we start understanding the nature of this allergy, and I'm going to expand it more tomorrow, and I'll talk more about the nature of the allergy and defining it for compulsive eaters. I found, for instance, that, and our OA 12 and 12 has a page on this, it is not simply certain foods, it is certain food ingredients for me, and it is certain eating behaviors. And I'll talk about that tomorrow. So tomorrow I'm going to do, I know there's some people coming for the first time tomorrow, I'll do a little bit of a summary of the allergy of the body. The obsession of the mind I haven't talked about yet, so I'll get onto that tomorrow. But I'll start off tomorrow after the summary with talking about how to develop a plan of eating and how to develop one that fits you, not me. Because the one that fits me might not fit you at all. As a matter of fact, it probably won't. And there are many different kinds of plans of eating, many different ways to try. The essential one is that you're honest with yourself. And if you want to start thinking about that, ask yourself, first of all, the question, if you're not abstinent, what will I never, ever, ever give up? What can I not imagine living without? Believe me, that's the first thing you should give up. But the beauty of the big book and the beauty of the 12 steps is this. If you give it up and you work the steps, guaranteed by the time you finish step 9, you won't want that stuff again. You won't miss it. And that's the miracle. It's not that you're giving it up. It's not that you haven't eaten it for X number of years or months or whatever. It's that you won't want it. You're completely protected from going back to it. And that, for me, is the miracle. That's what a 12-step program is all about. It's not about support group helping us all to keep from eating. There are other support groups that do that. It is about the miracle of being able to be around it, to watch other people eat it and not want it. I'll finish with this story, which for me is the absolute miracle. My wife and I will go out to a fancy restaurant. They will bring the dessert table after the meal around. She will pick, she loves chocolate. She's addicted to chocolate in this one sense. She eats one piece of chocolate a day. That's it. But at any rate, she will pick out a chocolate dessert that is, you know, decadent and full of richness or something. And she will take a bite of it and she will go, oh. I'm almost jealous of that piece of cake. But anyway, and she'll eat it. And she will eat half of it and put her fork down and say, I can't eat anymore. And the miracle for me, one is, I don't even want to try it. That's a miracle for me. Secondly, I don't want to eat the rest of it. I don't want to, you know, I don't want the, even if it went to waste, I would rather it went to waste. And third, I'm not angry at her. And I used to be angry at her. And so this miracle that I've lived with now for over 20 years is the result of the steps. It certainly isn't anything I ever did, other than follow directions. So I'll end with this, the general outline. Steps 1 and 2 are understanding the problem and understanding the solution. They aren't steps that you take because it's just a question of understanding. Step 3 is just a decision. You take it, you go on quickly. Steps 4 through 9 are the meat of the program, if you will, meat and potatoes of the program. And step 4 can be done with the Big Book way within a week or two, 6 weeks at the most. If it takes any longer, you must be in a coma, or else you're delaying it. Because it could take 2.5 hours a day to be done. Step 5, 6, 7, and 8 are done the same day. Step 9 is the amends. And they can be done relatively quickly, depending on how many meds you have. But as you start to work them, you will then not want to eat the foods that used to beckon to you, that you've given up in your plan of eating. So if you work the steps quickly, you will not relapse. You will just go on and not want them. And then steps 10, 11, and 12 are keeping what you already have. I do not do steps 1 through 9 anymore. I've done them. I recovered. I do steps 10, 11, and 12. That keeps me in recovery. Clean house, trust God, help others. That's Dr. Bob's supposed prescription to the alcoholic. That's steps 10, clean house. Step 11, trust God. Step 12, help others. And I'll explain how I, as a complete agnostic, almost atheist, find God, because I do have a God. Not the one most people in this room probably have, but I do have one. And I'm even going to mention, I hope I pronounce his name correctly, Soren Kierkegaard, whose 200th anniversary of the birth is this year. And I'm going to mention him when we talk about God. So that's the end of today, and I'll see you tomorrow at 9 o'clock. Thank you.